This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All parties having anything to do before the Honorable First Justice Beverly Cannoni, now sitting in the ghetto, Superior Court within the Court of County of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth and this good court. Thank you, Mr. Chief Clerk, Your Honor.
Your Honor, this is 22A2117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Can I have counsel identify themselves for the record, starting with the Commonwealth?
Adam Lally for the Commonwealth. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Your Honor. Laura McLaughlin for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Ms. McLaughlin.
Ellen Jackson on behalf of Ms. Reed. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Elizabeth Little also on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Ms. Little.
Good morning, Judge David Unetti for Karen Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Unetti. Good morning, Ms. Reed. Good morning, jurors.
So I have to ask you those same three questions. Were you all able to follow the instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left here on Tuesday?
No.
Everyone said no or shook their heads. So, jurors, from time to time, I will give you instructions or talk to you for a few minutes about how you evaluate evidence. So I just want to take a couple of minutes today. It's part of my job, where my job is to teach the jury about the law. So in considering the testimony of any witness, please remember that questions are not evidence. Only the answers, which are in fact the only part of the exchange between the lawyer and the witness that are given under oath, are evidence. So, if a witness is asked, isn't it true that after you learn that your uncle left you money in his will, you poisoned him? And the witness answers, no. Based solely on that question and that answer, there is no evidence that the witness has an uncle, that the uncle had a will, that the uncle left the witness money, that the witness knew that he did, or that the witness poisoned him. So going forward, I want you to consider the evidence in that regard. Also, there were videos shown to you, and I expect that throughout the course of this trial, there'll be many more videos shown to you. These videos are evidence, and there's audio on these. So what the video shows is for you folks to decide. Not me, not any of the lawyers. What an audio recording says is for you to decide. Not me, not any of the lawyers, because you find the facts. That's your job. We all have different jobs, but finding the facts in the case is your job. Okay? So with that, please get your Commonwealth's witness back on the stand, Mr. Flamati. Jim?
Yes.
Swear him in again, please. Thank you.
Just watch your step, Mom. May I see you to raise your right hand one more time? Do you solemnly swear the evidence you give the court and jury the case now and here? Show you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lally, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, before I begin, may I just approach the witness to return Exhibit 1?
Sure.
From the court.
160.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Now, Firefighter Flamati, Leave when we had left off the other day. You had arrived in the area of 34 Fairview Road, is that correct?
Correct.
And when you arrived there, what, if anything, did you do upon your arrival?
So on arrival, positioning the apparatus is going to be our most important thing, trying to figure out where our patient is and parking our apparatus close enough, especially at nighttime, that we can light up the scene as well as we can to try and figure out how to approach a scene, because if we have to trek equipment farther distances, it can slow our response down, so we try and make sure our arrival and positioning is as best as we can put it.
And as far as positioning in reference to when you first are sort of pulling up on the scene, where are you in the ambulance again?
So I would have been the passenger of the ambulance. Usually the tech that's leading into the call will sit on the passenger side to try and mentally get ready for what's going on, whether it's reviewing protocols or just trying to assess the information coming across the radio so you can update your treatment plan as much as you can before you even see the victim.
And when the ambulance comes to a stop or it's parked at your position, where is, what if anything do you see sort of as far as the scene is concerned?
So we have our fire apparatus that are helping light up the scene, but we also have two female parties going by to the victim on the side of the road, and going back and forth between that person and the side of the road.
And from the position when you first arrive, are you able to see the person on the side of the road?
You can see a shape of a person, so we know that's where the patient is, because we reported that there was a party on the side of the road, so seeing a body shape, that clued us that that was where we were headed.
In addition to the ambulance that you're in, how many other vehicles are on scene when you get there?
When I get there, I believe it is engine 3 and car 5.
And beyond sort of the vehicles from your department, what, if any, other vehicles do you see when you get there?
If I remember correctly, it was just a personal vehicle. I don't remember if there's any police cars on scene at that time.
And from your orientation when you pull up, where is the body positioned? To your left, to your right, or something like
that? To my left.
And so after the ambulance is positioned, what do you do from there?
So then it's going to be bringing all the equipment over to the patient's side to be able to extricate them from that situation, whether it's a house or a street or a road. We assess where they are and then the best tools to get them out into the ambulance to be able to work effectively on the patient.
When you proceed over to, now again, at some point subsequent later on, are you able to identify who the person on the ground is?
Yes. We will try and get a general idea of the age of the patient, the positioning of the patient, how they were found, and then when we get them into the ambulance, we can start identifying ways to register that patient in the emergency room. So identifiers, whether it's a license or witnesses, or we try and figure out who they are so they can get registered at the hospital.
And at some point, were you able to identify who this person was?
That's correct. His wallet was in his pocket, and we were able to grab his license.
And who were you able to identify as?
That was John O'Keefe.
And so, with reference to Mr. O'Keefe, when you first observed him on the ground, how far away from the street or the roadway is he at that point?
I'd say approximately 10 feet away from the road.
And how is he positioned as far as how is his body positioned on the ground?
I'd have to remove, but I believe he was supine on his back.
And just in general terms, first, when you're responding to a call of this nature, what are some of the protocols or that you were speaking about? What is it that you're seeking to do or assess when you first arrive?
So we're trying to determine if it's a cardiac arrest, that whether it's a viable transport or workable arrest. We have certain protocols within the Massachusetts protocols for whether we work the patient or we leave the patient on scene if it's a police matter, if there's injuries not sustainable with life. So we're trying to make that assessment before we make any decisions.
Let me stop you there just for 1 second. You do use the term as far as cardiac arrest. Based on your training experience, what do you understand that term?
So cardiac arrest, to the best of my knowledge, is just the cessation of electrical and mechanical activity in the cardiac muscle. So the cardiac muscle pumps blood throughout the body, and when that stops, all life stops after that.
Now, in particular reference to the conditions, the weather conditions that you find yourself in. What, if anything else, is sort of on the scale or spectrum in regard to diagnosis of this?
So cardiac arrest, depending on where they're found, we try and figure out what led them to be at that point. So we're looking at weather conditions as well. That can also affect viability of resuscitation. So due to the extreme weather, extreme cold, we'll attempt resuscitation on that patient due to the fact that it'll prolong viability of the arrest or ability to recover from cardiac arrest afterwards. So weather is definitely a key factor in where they are found.
And you're familiar with the term based on your training experience called hypothermia?
Correct.
And so what, if any, sort of relationship does cardiac arrest have? Well, let me ask you this first. What is your understanding of the term hypothermia?
The exposure to extreme cold that lowers your core and extremity temperatures down to a below 95 degrees, usually.
And what, if any, interplay is there between hypothermia and cardiac arrest?
So like I said before, it'll prolong how long it'll preserve the body after arrest. So if somebody's found in like a cold water situation, there's been multiple reports of patients recovering after being drowned in cold water for up to an hour. So viability is definitely improved by the cold weather.
As far as viability is concerned, you talk about doing your assessment. What are sort of the steps that go into your assessment?
So we're looking at obvious signs of death. So we're looking at exposure of brain matter. We're looking at traumatic injuries, decapitation, things that would basically be non-life sustainable. We're looking at signs of lividity and rigor to basically show us how long the patient has been down for.
And the age of a particular patient, what, if any, relationship does that have to your assessment?
So it'll show the extent of frailty the patient has. If somebody's an elderly patient, severe cancer patient, their ability to sustain a cardiac event like that is less. So somebody that's younger or middle-aged will have a much better chance of recovery afterwards. But that would really be the only key that we're looking at.
And what, if any, observations did you make of Mr. O'Keefe during your assessment of him initially?
Just that he was a middle-aged male, and that was all we had.
And as far as the other things that you were talking about, as far as viability or resuscitation, mm-hmm. What, if anything, did you observe with reference to Mr. Keefe in regard to that?
So with viability, we were looking at any rigidity or rigor in the body, or lividity or separation of blood. You'd have a pooling of blood or bruising, it would look like, at the lower parts of the body, depending on how the person's positioned, basically. If they're supine, you'd have positioning or pooling underneath the body, and then you would have stiffness of the arms, legs, jaw, neck. To be able to move the body, we're looking to, if they don't have those things present, it's another check mark of saying this is viable, we can work this.
And specifically as it applies to your assessment of Mr. O'Keefe, what, if anything, do you recall in regard to that initial assessment as far as viability?
So his limbs were able to be moved, jaw was able to be moved, the posterior of his body was red, so not the indicative of lividity that we're looking for. So we termed it to be a viable arrest and continue to work.
You mentioned as far as sort of gathering your equipment, bringing it over to Mr. O'Keefe, what, if any, equipment did you gather?
So equipment initially is going to be our scoop stretcher to be able to pick the patient up, break apart, put it underneath him. We have a first in bag, an airway bag, cardiac monitor. We'll bring all that over to the patient's side to be able to do as much as we can in that situation. But due to the weather, we wanted to get him out of the weather because that was one of the things that was hurting him at that point, is getting him into the warmer ambulance and beginning the warming process. So get into an area where we can assess the patient thoroughly with good lighting and to be able to expose the patient, begin the warming process.
And when you go over to where Mr. O'Keefe is, about 10 feet off of the roadway, who, if anyone, from your department goes along with you?
So I have Matt Kelly with me and Tim Nuttall. I also have Frank Walsh, Katie McLaughlin, and Greg Woodbury, and Captain Robery.
And as far as this sort of initial assessment on the ground with Mr. O'Keefe, what, if anything, were sort of each of those prospective people doing with regard to Mr. O'Keefe?
I'd have to review specific interventions as far as who did what when. But that's why we document things immediately afterwards, so it's all fresh. So CPR was initiated by me, and ALS assessment as well. So I can go over individual interventions if you'd like, but it's really your call.
And for the record, sir, you're looking at exhibit number 160, and what page of that are you looking at?
It says 205 of my EMS report, but there's also the ANFRS report on the top as well.
So initially, when you go over to Mr. O'Keefe, how many other people are sort of in that area at that time?
So in the area, we have the first responders, and then we have the two female parties on scene.
Where were the two females in relation to Mr. O'Keefe?
So as we're approaching the scene, they were kind of in between us and the patient, so we tried to gather as much information as we could from them as we could.
So once you make that determination as far as viability of resuscitative efforts, sort of specifically what are you and the other firefighters doing in regard to those efforts with Mr. O'Keefe?
So we're beginning CPR. We're trying to establish good quality CPR, get the patient onto our stretcher, begin an IO, start medication, start ventilating the patient, all this, all of the conditions that the body has, we're trying to remedy through intervention. So we're trying to breathe for the patient. We're starting to press on his chest to do CPR to cause his cardiac muscle to compress, spread blood through the heart, cardiac muscle, cerebral brain. And we're trying to reverse what's happening in the body.
Now, as far as when Mr. O'Keefe, you observe him on the ground, what, if any, snow did you observe on or around him in that area?
So the snow was probably up to the mid-axillary point, so we're looking at probably halfway up his rib point. Top of his body was clear.
And do you know about how much snow was covering his body up to the mid-axillary?
I'd say probably about 4 inches, 4 to 6 inches.
Now, as far as your observations, Mr. O'Keefe, when he's on the ground, what, if any, observations did you make as far as how he was dressed?
For the exposure, I'd say he was pretty underdressed. Long sleeve t-shirt, jeans, nothing really substantial to be out in that type of weather.
And at this point, or any subsequent point, what, if any, observations did you make of Mr. O'Keefe's footwear?
By the time so our first priority is obviously going to be treating the patient. His clothes do matter, but it's on the list of priorities, not huge. So by the time we figured out he was missing one of his shoes, we were already at the hospital at that point.
And do you recall which of his shoes he was missing?
I don't know.
And as far as that missing shoe, was that something that you or any of the other firefighters, paramedics would have needed to have removed on scene pursuant to any sort of treatment?
Nothing would have been done through the feet. It would have been just exposure of the patient to see possibly the extent of frostbite. If it had started affecting his extremities, fingers, nose, that type of thing, a hypothermic reaction there.
Would that be something that would have been removed by one of you or one of the other firefighters while he was on the ground?
If it would have been removed, both of them would have been removed to assess that. It wouldn't do much good to just remove one and leave it there on scene.
Now, as far as the two females that you observed, did they sort of remain in the same position you initially observed them? Did they move around or something else?
They kind of cleared a little bit away from the scene. I would say they moved off to the right of the apparatus so we could work on the patient at that time.
And what, if any, conversation or what, if anything, did you ask either of those two females?
So how the patient was found and what brought them to that situation is critical. So we're trying to figure out as much information past medical history that we can of the patient. So we're trying to find somebody who has knowledge of the event. So we're, as we approach the scene, begin to talk to one of the females. What is going on? Why are they there? What's going, just what happened?
And you say you're speaking to one of the two females, is that correct?
That's correct.
You see any of those females in the courtroom today?
That's correct, Ms. Reed.
Could you just identify as to where Ms. Reed is seated or an article of clothing she's wearing?
Right there.
I can only just ask the record reflect identification.
Okay.
Now, with regard to one of the two females that you were talking to, was that Ms. Reed or was that somebody else?
That was Ms. Reed.
And why, if at all, were you talking to her versus one of the other females that you observed?
She seemed to be the one that was most personally affected by it, so I figured she'd had the most information about why the person was there.
And what, if any, observations did you make of her in regard to your conclusion that she was the one who seemed the most personally affected by it?
She was the most distressed on scene, obviously upset. So, personally related to or had a relationship with the person.
Before we get to any conversations, what, if anything, did you observe Ms. Reed or any of the females doing with reference to Mr. O'Keefe's body when you first started to come up to this?
So I would characterize it as an attempted resuscitation. She was attempting to do CPR, but due to the erratic behavior, she was running back and forth between the other female on scene and the body, back and forth, trying to press on his chest, wake him up, talk to him, just to no avail.
And as far as your conversation with Ms. Reed, what, if any, questions did she ask in regard to either demographics or anything else?
So do you have any information of who this is? How are they here? Tried to get any type of information we could from her at that time, but with no luck.
When you say with no luck, what, if any, response did you receive from Ms. Reed in regard to your question?
So the only response that I was personally given was just, I hit him, I hit him. Oh my God, I hit him.
And when she's saying, I hit him, oh my God, I hit him, how loudly is she saying that?
So she was within 2 feet of me, but very loud. Any type of follow-up questioning, did you hit him with your hand? Did you kick him? What happened? She just repeated the phrase over and over again, I hit him, I hit him.
Just to be clear, where does this conversation occur?
This was as we're bringing equipment over to the patient. The interventions are going to be started basically by whoever gets over to the scene first. I'm trying to gather information as a lead paramedic to try and coordinate interventions and therapy to kind of holistically be the team leader in that situation and treat and transport the patient. So it was on approach to the patient, probably halfway between the ambulance and the patient.
And with regard to that treatment of Mr. O'Keefe, I think you referenced it earlier being within your report. What were sort of those steps or what, if anything, did you and the other firefighters do with regard to treatment? Before you answer that, Your Honor, may I request, may the witness just refer to the DMS report as he goes?
Yes, if need be.
Thank you. So we try and document through our flowchart of all of the interventions that we're doing. So CPR is obviously going to be our first priority. CPR is initiated, unchanged, but successful in the actual intervention itself, no complications. We do our ALS assessment that we talked about of any further indications of this is not a viable arrest. We determined it was a viable arrest and we move on. Then we're going to start. We refer to it as a bag valve mask at 15 liters per minute on oxygen. The patient's not breathing on their own, so we're trying to assist ventilating that with high flow oxygen as well. An easy IO, which is a needle we put into the bone of the tibia of the patient. That was on the right tibia was the first one we put in. We're going to be putting in warm fluid We have a warmer in the back to be able to bring up the core temperature. Then we start with epinephrine, 1 milligram through that IO.
If I could just stop you there for 1 second. When you say as far as IO, put it into the leg, how is that sort of inserted into the leg?
So we have two different methods we can do. We have a drill, a power drill that drills through the outer layer of the bone to into the capillary area of the bone, a soft but spongy material. So we drill through that, or we can do it by hand if that fails.
And when it comes to the epinephrine, what is sort of the purpose of that medication, and what are you trying to do with that medication?
So that medication will improve, it's a vasoconstrictor. It'll cause the vasculature to constrict, so it'll improve the quality or effectiveness on the cardiac muscle, cardiac vasculature, and the cerebral area.
As far as the administration of epinephrine is concerned, is that something that's done once or more than once, and is there a protocol for that?
So it's going to be serial every 3 to 5 minutes during the cardiac arrest to try and bring them over to the hospital so it continues that entire time, unless there's a rhythm change or that can change our algorithm of how we approach the patient, if there's a rhythm regain or return of spontaneous circulation.
And so how many times or what times was the epinephrine administered via the IO to Mr. Oakley?
Okay, so I have epinephrine at 620, 625, 630, 635, 640, 645.
And when was that first administered? Would that have been at some point when he was outside of the ambulance on the ground or in the ambulance or something else?
It would be dependent on transport time. So our first, we're at patient side at 6:15, transport 6:27. So best estimation would have been inside of the ambulance at that point.
I'm sorry I interrupted you before, but after sort of the introduction of the epinephrine, what if anything did you and the other firefighters?
After the first round?
Yeah.
So first round of epinephrine, after that we would drop in what's called an OPA. That would be to push the tongue out of the way, open up the airway to improve our bag valve mass so it has an open air way to get the oxygen into the lungs. We begin external warming, stripping the patient, getting the heat turned up in the back of the ambulance. We would then switch over from manual CPR done by hand to a mechanical CPR device to ensure adequate, consistent CPR compressions of the chest. It was a Lucas device. Put that on the patient. And then we continue with another round of epi. Patient's starting to warm up this time, so we would do suction at that point to try and suction fluid out of the airway to improve ventilation efforts. Another round of epi is done. We have another suction, this time through a deep suction via the endotracheal tube. Sorry, at 6:22 after warming, we intubated the patient. We have a 7.5 tube paced at 27 centimeters, and then verified through various means, through chest rise, auscultation, waveform, and tidal CO2. So we had complications listed as patient vomiting, aspirating. Suction was then done with a rigid tip suction device. After successful intubation, we then suctioned via French tube through the airway established. Jump back up to 6:31. Another IO line was established on the opposite tibia on the left side. And then another three rounds of epi and then arrival at the hospital.
What was the arrival time at the hospital?
At destination was 6:45.
What hospital was that again? I'm sorry.
Good Samaritan Medical Center.
There's a term that you use in your reports called, and I'll probably butcher this, but asystole, is that correct?
Yeah, asystole is going to be a cardiac rhythm where there is no electrical activity in the heart and is referred to as flatline.
What, if any, observations did you make in your treatment diagnosis in regards to Mr. O'Keefe as far as asystole?
So that was the rhythm he was found in. Yeah, from initial rhythm I have on the EKG at 632 is asystole. So we'd basically observe that for any changes, whether it's increase of electrical activity, regain of adequate pulses, all of that can kind of be hinted at with the cardiac rhythm. And then we would change our algorithm based on whether we go down the ROSC protocol or we continue down the cardiac arrest protocol.
And whether it's on scene or it's in the ambulance, is there sort of a division of task or a division of different skill that's being employed in patient care?
So patient care will have to do with level of training and also proximity on the patient. Where you get into the ambulance is just logistically, if you have the training, it's not a huge open ER, it's a small environment. So we try and not have people jump over each other as best as we can.
And if you recall, who was sort of doing what in relation to treatment of this patient?
So in the back of the ambulance specifically?
Yes.
Okay, in the back of the ambulance, Tim Nuttall was managing the airway. I was the team lead that was kind of coordinating all of the interventions. Matt Kelly was assisting in gathering equipment, doing CPR before the mechanical device was placed on. Basically, they asked act as an assistant to hand equipment, place things in strategic areas around so we can actually work without having to go get those physical things ourselves.
Now, as far as you indicated removal of Mr. O'Keefe's clothing once in the ambulance, correct?
Yes.
What was it about the sort of the condition of the clothing that led to the removal of that?
So removal of clothing is actually pretty standard for any cardiac arrest, any traumatic injuries. We're basically trying to get further clues because this is all happening very quickly. So we're trying to get more evidence of why are they here. We're looking for extremity injuries, crush injuries, bruising, anything that would that we could document that we could pass on to the emergency room staff and doctors. So we would strip most patients.
And as far as, were you involved personally as far as sort of the cutting of the clothing and stripping
yes.
the patient?
Yes.
And upon removal of the clothing, what, if anything, did you observe as to sort of the condition of the clothing or texture of the clothing at that point?
Condition seemed pretty well intact, but just wet and cold.
And what, if any, relationship would the wet and cold clothing have to any of the diagnoses that you were running through in regard to Mr. O'Keefe?
It would really just be the exposure to the weather would be our biggest trigger off of that, or if you had protruding injuries through the clothing, compound fractures, things like that. The clothing was intact, but we knew it was wet, it was cold, so as we strip things off of him, we can see underneath, basically, if there are any sub... Not every fracture breaks through the skin, not everything causes obvious things, obvious signs. So as we strip the patient, we can begin to further assess.
Let me take you back just for a second to outside of the ambulance.
Yep.
What, if anything, specifically were you able to observe with reference to any injuries Mr. O'Keefe had sustained?
Injuries are pretty tough to see outside of the ambulance just due to the weather, due to the lighting. We have seen lighting on the ambulance as well, but...
Let me ask you, as far as what if any difference did you know between the lighting in the back of the ambulance versus when you were with Mr. O'Keefe on the ground?
So he was still out in the weather at that point, so bleeding wasn't really obvious at that point. As soon as we get him into the back of the ambulance, then we start noticing hemorrhage from different areas of his body.
And when you say hemorrhage from different areas, which areas specifically?
So mostly from his mouth, his eyes, nose. Yeah.
And just to be clear for the record, when you use the term hemorrhage based on your training experience, what do you understand that?
Bleeding, external bleeding.
Now, you mentioned that there was some suctioning of Mr. O'Keefe's airway, is that correct?
Correct.
And what, if anything, specifically was suctioned from Mr. O'Keefe's airway?
Suctioning from the airway was mostly blood, blood, sputum.
And as far as how much, what if anything you have to sort of measure how much blood was suctioned out of Mr. O'Keefe's airway?
So we have a canister that has marks of milliliters, so we can determine as we're suctioning how much is in that container at different times.
And about how much, based on that, was suctioned from Mr. O'Keefe's airway?
So the initial suctioning with the rigid tip was about 150 milliliters. And subsequently, so that would have been above the airway, in the mouth, in that type of area. We established the intubation. And then deep suctioning with that soft tip through the intubation tube would have been another 50 milliliters of fluid.
Now, with reference to, you mentioned to some observations of Mr. O'Keefe's back, correct?
What's that? Sorry.
You mentioned some observations you made earlier in reference to Mr. O'Keefe's back?
Yes.
And what were those again?
So, that would have been redness of the skin and the posterior of the body.
What, if any, significance did that have to you as far as your observation of that?
So, redness from the skin, if it's general or across the body, can mean certain things. If it's just a particular area, and due to the fact that it was cold outside, that would have been the initial stages of frostbite or exposure to cold.
And as far as the remainder of Mr. O'Keefe's body, what, if any, other observations did you make, and which areas did you make those observations to in regard to the initial state?
So, for as far as the cold exposure?
Yeah.
Cold exposure, we're looking at the most exterior parts. Extreme cold exposure can lead to frost nip and frostbite in different areas. The first affected areas are going to be your fingers, your ears, your nose, your toes, that type of. So that was a cold, waxy, pale, stark white substance, basically, or condition of his skin.
And on each of those areas that you just described?
Yes.
Okay. Now, sort of up in the area of Mr. O'Keefe's head, you mentioned some bleeding from the eyes and the nose, correct?
Yes.
As well as his mouth?
Yes.
And beyond that, what, if any, observations did you make of any other sort of injuries to his head or his face?
So his eyes were pretty well swollen. We were trying to clear areas of blood to figure out if there were any contusions around the head. I believe there was a contusion on his forehead. Also had some markings on his extremities as well.
And just as far as your understanding, based on your training experience, when you use the word contusion, what do you understand that?
Bruising.
And before we get to the extremities, what, if any, observations did you make as far as Mr. O'Keefe's abdomen?
Abdomen we noted as significant as distension or swelling of the belly.
And what, if any, significance did that have to you in regard to Mr. O'Keefe?
It's another of our detailed assessments. We go through the body in a more detailed way to try and find more clues that we can pass on for the assessment. Distension in the belly could be due to trauma or bloating. It could be, those are usually our biggest triggers for distension.
Now, you mentioned as far as the extremities are concerned, what, if anything, did you observe as far as injuries to Mr. O'Keefe?
So we're looking at, so we had the cold, rigid fingers, hands, feet, and then we had multiple dry blood lacerations to the right arm.
Do you recall specifically where on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm?
It would have been his upper arm.
And you mentioned dry blood, is that correct?
Yes.
So these were not actively bleeding at the time that you observed them?
No.
Now, as far as being dry blood versus actively bleeding, what, if anything, does that indicate to you as far as sort of timing?
So we had active bleeding from other areas in the body. So the fact that it had already stopped and clotted, I would assume that would have been several hours before the incident that led him to be there, but I would guess earlier in the evening.
Now, as far as the history is concerned, your attempts on scene, and then what, if any, attempts were made subsequent when you were in the ambulance to obtain any sort of history of how Mr. O'Keefe can be there, or what, if anything, causing injuries you observed?
Once we get the patient into the ambulance, there was no family, no bystanders in the back of the ambulance, so then it's going to be solely based on physical assessment.
And within sort of the team of firefighters that you had, who, if anyone, did you direct to try and obtain that information while you were in the back?
So that would have been Katie McLaughlin.
And what did you ask Mr. McLaughlin to do?
So Katie was one of our senior paramedics at the time. So we had enough skilled hands working on the patient at that time. So to direct her, I wasn't able to get as much information and still had a skill to do, or still had a task to do, to run the cardiac arrest. So I pushed, I didn't push, I directed Ms. Reed over to Katie to try and gather more information as to why they were there. If you could get any more information about who he was, events leading to the injury, how long he was down for, any type of information, and then moved on to the patient at that point.
And so Firefighter McLaughlin is having this conversation outside of the ambulance, is that correct?
That's correct.
This is going on while you're inside of the ambulance actively treating Mr. O'Keefe.
It was a very quick process. So I start the conversation, wasn't productive, wasn't moving forward, moved her over to Firefighter McLaughlin, continued on to the patient, and then started treatment, moved the patient in, and then Katie came into the back of the ambulance to help. So it was a very quick process.
Now, as far as Mr. O'Keefe's eyes were concerned, what, if any, observations further did you make as far as Mr. O'Keefe's eyes?
So both eyes were swollen and bleeding.
What, if any, observations were you able to make of his pupils?
Pupils. So I have documented as 4 millimeters and non-reactive.
What if any, significance of those observations as far as 4 millimeters and non-reactive?
So we're looking for equality between the two. So signs of bleeding can be demonstrated by unequal pupils, or if they were restricted, could lead us to believe it was as a result of an opioid interaction. But we're looking at whether they react to light as well. If there's brain activity, if there's still something causing the body to react, you'll have some type of pupillary response. So we shine light, there were no response, so it was fixed and at 4 millimeters.
Now, at some point, you leave the scene in route to Good Samaritan, is that correct?
That's correct.
And who is continuing treatment of Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the ambulance during transport?
So the back of the ambulance and transport would have been Firefighter Kelly, Firefighter Nuttall, and myself.
And who, if anyone, was driving the ambulance between Fairview and Good Samaritan?
So that'll be determined by basically just positioning on the engine. So the step driver for that position would then drive as the detailed person over to the ambulance, and that was Firefighter McLaughlin.
Now, during the transport from Fairview to Good Samaritan, what, if anything, are you and the other firefighters in the back of the ambulance doing as far as continuing treatment of the stroke?
So we started transport at 6:27. So between 6:27 and 6:45, treatments included epinephrine, additional suctioning, managing the airway, placing another intraosseous line, and then 3 additional rounds of epinephrine while the mechanical CPR is continuing CPR.
And during the course of the transport, what, if any, changes in Mr. O'Keefe's status as far as the cardiac arrest or the breathing occurs during the transport?
No changes.
Now, that time that it took to get from Fairview to Good Samaritan, is that sort of a typical transport time?
Not normally. Due to the weather, it was pretty slow driving. Even though the ambulance was a smaller vehicle than the engine, slow transport compared to normal.
And during the course of the transport, what, if any, communication are you having with Good Samaritan in regard to Mr. O'Keefe and his eventual arrival there?
Every medical that goes on, We try to give the hospital staff a heads up, basically, of what's coming in. We'll have different alerts that we would give them, whether it's a cardiac arrest, a stroke, a STEMI, to have the certain appropriate teams come in and be ready, whether it's a trauma alert. There's different specialties within the hospital that'll treat those different particular cases. So we call them 5 to 10 minutes prior to give that team time to get down into the emergency room to get ready to work.
When you arrived at Good Samaritan, with anyone were you met by, and sort of what happened with regard to Mr. O'Keefe at that point?
So we're continuing interventions from the ambulance through the bay into their cold room. We're then met by registration, a registered nurse, and the doctor that took care of the patient, as well as a team of other assistants and CNAs.
And where do you physically go with Mr. O'Keefe, or how does that work?
Yep, so that's referred to as a transfer of care. So there's different people, like I said, it's a team base where different people are in charge of different things. We'll have the nurse in charge that's in charge of documenting our interventions that have been done so far, time of down, the patient was down, and then she starts documenting all the different interventions that were done by the hospital staff as well. You also give a report to the doctor who's then taking over as lead for the cardiac arrest. They're going to start issuing orders for the patient and treatment. And then you have registration that will get the information to register the patient that they can tie all of their interventions to.
And during that sort of process of exchange of information and things of that nature, what, if anything, did you learn in regard to the sort of core body temperature of Mr. O'Keefe?
So to add that assessment, I believe it was, he had core body temperature of 80 degrees.
What, if any, significance does that have in regard to sort of the typical core body temperature?
Typical core body temperature is going to be in the high 90s. Where body temperature being at 80 with a rectal temp or core temp is going to be extreme hypothermia.
Now, you're at Good Samaritan for a certain amount of time, correct, before you clear?
Correct.
And at that point in time, while you were at Good Samaritan, that initial time, what, if anything, did you learn as far as Mr. O'Keefe's status or what had happened to you?
So as we talked about before with the hypothermia and the extreme cold, they're going to work that for an extended period of time. Most cardiac arrests, I will try and hang out by the patient or in the area. As new staff come through, different things are found. The doctors and nurses might have follow-up questions. So I try to stay available as an asset that they can bounce those questions off, at least for 10 or 15 minutes afterwards, to make sure the whole process is completely transferred from all the interested parties.
And during that course of time, what, if anything, did you learn as sort of the eventual status of Mr. O'Keefe?
We didn't learn anything while we were at the hospital. We then cleared the hospital, returned back to quarters to decon the ambulance and to replenish all the equipment that we had used, get back in service, and move on with the shift.
At some point during the course of the shift, did you have occasion to go back to Good Samaritan?
Me personally, no. It would have been for an additional medical call if there was any calls for service afterwards.
Did you recall whether or not you went back to Good Samaritan for any additional medical calls or anything of that nature?
I don't recall.
If I could direct your attention to the screen just over there. Ms. Gilman, if I could please have exhibit number 9. So directing your attention to what's been previously marked as exhibit number 9 up on the screen, do you recognize what's in that photograph?
The house.
Is that the house that you responded to? Is that correct?
Correct.
And Ms. Gilman, if I could have exhibit number Ms. Gilman, if I could have exhibit number 14. And again, sir, what's up on screen? Do you recognize what that is?
I see blood, snow, general area, not sure.
And lastly, Mr. Gilman, if I could have exhibit number 18. And again, firefighter Formati, do you recognize what's depicted up on screen as exhibit number 18?
Yes.
Can I approach the witness room?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
So, I'm going to hand you a laser pointer. Yes. Basically, just press on this button here and this direction over the screen. So, firefighter Flamati, within this photograph up on the screen is Exhibit 18. Do you see the area in which you observed Mr. O'Keefe's lying on the ground when you first arrived?
Yes. Okay.
And using that laser pointer, could you direct the jury's attention to where in this photograph you observed Mr. O'Keefe when he initially arrived?
Initially arrived would have been in this area here.
Thanks. May I have just one moment, Your Honor?
Yes. Dave, you can turn. Thank you.
Nothing further for this witness at this time, Your Honor.
All right, cross-examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to start sort of at the beginning. When you first arrived
Yes.
at the location, you indicated that you could, in fact, see the body from your perspective, correct?
I could see a body, yes.
And you, I think you indicated the shape of the body.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell if it was female or male.
No.
But no. Obviously looked like a human figure.
Yes.
Okay. That drew your attention to the left side of the ambulance as you were approaching, correct?
Yes.
And you're sitting on the right side, which means you're sort of the furthest away from that figure from the perspective of the ambulance.
And the ambulance, yes.
And you had no problem making out that figure in the snow?
So figure in the snow, we had a good distance between the ambulance and the engine, so yes.
Okay. And you indicated that the figure in the snow was on top of the snow, if you will, with some snow accumulating up the body of the individual.
Yes.
But he was not covered in snow.
No.
There wasn't like a mound of snow over this figure.
There were mounds of snow in the area, but not over the patient. Due to the wind, there were snow drifts in the area.
And his clothes were dark as compared to the white snow.
Yes.
I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about some of the last conversation you had with Mr. Lally about the injuries. You did note that Mr. O'Keefe had a laceration over his right eye, correct?
No, over his right eye?
Over his right eye.
It was a contusion over the eye.
Okay, and your definition of a contusion is?
Bruising.
Was it also swollen?
There was swelling around the eyes and a little bit of contusion and bruising around.
Did you see an actively bleeding laceration over his right eye?
I don't recall.
You don't remember that? What about his left eye?
Both eyes were pretty well swollen shut.
What about not from the nostrils, but on the skin on the nose? Did you note a laceration or multiple lacerations on the nose?
So due to the bleeding that was coming from the orifices, trying to clean the area and find exactly where it's from is sometimes difficult, so we can just say it was bleeding in that area.
Okay, so you can't define, as you sit here, you don't remember if it was bleeding from the nostril or from a laceration on the nose?
I believe it was the nostrils.
Okay. Yeah. Are you saying that there was no laceration on the skin of the nose, or you just don't recall it?
On the top of the nose, no, I don't know.
I'm sorry?
On the top of the nose, I don't recall.
You don't recall, okay. With regard to his abdomen, you indicated that it was distended.
Yes.
Medical term for swollen.
Yep.
You said that could be from trauma, or it could be just bloating, correct?
Correct.
Did you notice any contusions on his abdomen?
No.
Any skin that was abraded?
No.
Or cut?
No.
So there was no bruising, no contusion, but there was a distension, correct?
Yes.
So there was no visible trauma to the abdomen?
Visible trauma doesn't really matter to internal trauma. It's not always indicative one way or the other.
So my question was, did you see any visible trauma on his abdomen?
No.
Okay. But you did note it, that it was bloated?
That it was distended, yeah.
Okay. I want to talk to you for a second about, if I could shift gears, about the conversation that you indicated to Mr. Lally that you had with Ms. Reed. You were also asked about that conversation at the grand jury when you testified, correct?
Correct.
You testified that as the lead paramedic, you were specifically trying to get as much information from my client, Ms. Reed, as you possibly could concerning the victim and how the victim ended up being there, correct?
Correct.
You indicated, in no particular order, that you asked questions like, how do you know him, correct?
Correct.
How did he get here?
Correct.
What happened?
Correct.
Is there any additional information you can give me about what happened to this person?
Correct.
Okay, so that was a conversation that you were personally engaged in with my client in order to gather as much data, if you will, about what you were dealing with, correct?
Correct.
But your focus was, when you first arrived, your focus is, I need to attend to the patient, correct?
Correct.
Like, conversations notwithstanding, I need to deal with what's in front of me, which is an unconscious man in the snow.
Correct.
Dressed inappropriately.
Correct.
And possibly freezing to death.
Correct.
But you did say that you had enough of a conversation with Ms. Reed that she answered you and said something to the effect of, I hit him, oh my God, I hit him.
Correct.
So then you followed up on that conversation, correct?
As much as I could, yes.
As a matter of fact, you said that you asked her additional elaborating questions.
Correct.
Well, did you hit him in the face? Or did you kick him? Or did you hit him with your hand?
Yep.
Okay. So that's a conversation that you're having with Ms. Reed face to face.
Correct.
You're talking to her, you're looking her in the eyes, she's looking you in the eyes, you're standing still, and you're attempting as best you can to converse with this woman so that you can gather as much information as you possibly can as you attend to the victim.
Correct.
You indicated that that conversation lasted long enough that the conversation was frustrated by the fact that you weren't getting information that was helpful to you. So you turned that conversation over to Katie McLaughlin.
Objection? Sustained. Ask it a different way.
Sure. Did you have, was your conversation in some way in your mind, and when I use the word frustrated, I mean it was just, you weren't getting the information that you were seeking, correct?
It wasn't productive.
Okay, better way to put it. I'll use your word. That conversation was unproductive enough that you then moved the conversation over to Ms. McLaughlin, correct?
Correct.
Firefighter McLaughlin. And once Firefighter McLaughlin engaged Ms. Reed, you then began to attend to the patient again.
So the patient was already being treated by the other personnel on scene.
Okay.
I started the conversation, realized it wasn't going anywhere. I had other responsibilities. So regardless of how they ended there, they still needed treatment.
Of course.
And transport. So that began my priority and moved her over to try and get as much information while treatment was being done.
What part of the treatment were you responsible for?
All of it.
Sorry, that's a great answer to a very vague question.
Yep.
What physically were you doing with Mr. O'Keefe?
In which particular moment?
When you first arrived and attended to him and physically touched him. In other words, were you the airway person? Were you the cardiac person? Were you doing chest compressions? Were you squeezing the bag?
I would have been doing chest compressions initially until I could delegate that task to somebody else.
Okay. And chest compressions, I'm going to butcher this because I've never been trained other than my little toddler. They look a little like what I'm doing now, correct?
Correct.
And I indicated one palm over my hand, arms extended, and you can see my shoulders moving up and down in a rhythmic fashion, correct?
Yes.
So if...
I didn't get an answer, correct?
Yes.
I'll wait till then. What were you wearing?
What was I wearing? My uniform.
Didn't expect that one, did you?
That was a different one. Heavy winter coat.
Okay.
My uniform.
Do paramedics wear sometimes yellow, bright yellow for safety?
Yes.
Were you wearing a bright yellow heavy winter coat?
I don't recall. I have a few different coats.
Got it. Do you remember what Ms. McLaughlin was wearing?
I don't.
Okay. That conversation that you had with Ms. Reed at the scene, that had to have lasted, I'm not guessing it was very long, but it had to have lasted a minute?
At most, yeah.
At most? Once you finished your conversation with Ms. Reed, did you then start attending specifically to the chest compressions and the high-level CPR that we've heard so much about from your colleague?
Yes.
As you're doing the CPR on the scene, that high-level CPR, high-quality CPR, was Mr. O'Keefe then moved to the scoop, which would then facilitate getting him on a gurney?
Correct.
That gurney was then moved between a couple of patrol cars, cruisers, and into the ambulance, correct?
Correct.
Once you were in the ambulance, the first priority is to get this person warm. Is that right?
First priority is always going to be CPR. The secondary would be getting them warmed up.
Okay. So obviously when you got into the ambulance, you would shut the doors.
Correct.
There's a heater on in the ambulance.
Yes.
You never came back out of that ambulance after you got Mr. O'Keefe into the ambulance, did you?
No.
Okay. And you were in there with firefighter Nuttall at the time?
Nuttall and Kelly.
And firefighter McLaughlin was outside the ambulance doing whatever she was doing?
Correct.
Okay.
Initially, and then she came in afterwards to assist. Yeah.
And did I hear you correctly? When firefighter McLaughlin got in the ambulance, she took over the driving responsibilities?
So there's two different compartments. They're not connected. There's a little window between the two areas. So she assisted with interventions in the back. And then after we had established everything we needed to on scene to begin transport, she then got out and then started driving.
Got it. Thank you. I'd like to play... But first, I'd like to have marked, I think it's already been marked, Exhibit 379. It's a video, a snippet of a video. It's probably 3 minutes long. It's not that long. I'd like to play that portion of the video for you. And when it's done, Firefighter Flamati, which is not that easy to say.
Did a great job.
I'm going to ask you to show me exactly where on the video, if you can, that you had this conversation.
For the laser pointer?
My client. Yes, you can use the laser pointer as you wish. This is just to orient you, if I may, Your Honor. The top, this, let me see if I can do this. Here we go. The top is a dash cam from one cruiser.
So I'm going to see Consulate Sidebar for a second, please.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.